Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome. I am August Baker. Today, the new book we're talking about is The Belief in Intuition, Individuality and Authority in Henry Bergson and Max Shaler, University of Pennsylvania Press, 2021. I'm pleased and honored to be speaking with the author, Professor Adriana Alfaro of the Mexican Autonomous Institute of Technology. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
I wanted to start with, this is a kind of strange quotation, but it's from a book by Bennett Berger, The Survival of a Counterculture, 1981, University of California Press. He's talking about the ubiquity of the term mind-blowing in the vocabulary of the counterculture. Says it was broadened to include a variety of experiences that shook up one's ordinary psychology, and that in blowing one's mind revealed some of the tacit assumptions on which one's ordinary organization of understanding was based. He also noted that it was first used to refer to powerful drug experiences, but eventually it had that wire. And I was thinking here that this is what you were doing, I felt, kind of mind-blowing in the sense of going back to these authors, Bergson and Shaler, and looking at some different ways of seeing things that maybe have gotten kind of lost in time, but we go back and think, oh, that's a very different way of looking at things. Is that your understanding of the project of intellectual history here?
The point of going back to these authors, yes, and, you know, recuperating some lost.
Yes.
So I guess from the perspective of the history of political thought, Bergson and Shaler's relative absence in contemporary debates is a symptom, I think, of political philosophy having forgotten some important alternatives it did not take, and perhaps could not take, after the decisive wars of the 20th century. I'm thinking especially about their emphasis on personal authority, which, as I see it, presents an alternative to Weber's charismatic authority. Mm-hmm. And of course, that was very, you know, very a difficult subject after the world wars in the 20th century.
Right.
I'm also thinking about lively and candid, perhaps, approach to metaphysics and morals, untainted by the suspicion, the distrust, and the wariness that characterizes many of the philosophical schools of the late 20th century after the wars, such as post-structuralism, post-modernism, mm-hmm. genealogy, all that kind of thing, mm-hmm. So, which I really appreciate and respect and learn from, but still. The book, I think, is an effort to recover key elements within ways of thought or roots of thought that were available before the wars, and mm-hmm. to show how that enriches our present discussions.
Understood. That agrees with my understanding. You start, and of course, the book is called The Belief in Intuition. And I think that comes from a quote that you start with from Hannah Arendt, who said that Bergson was the last philosopher to believe firmly in intuition. So tell us about intuition in philosophy. It doesn't seem like something, that a philosopher would be, espousing or saying was important.
Yeah, so perhaps we can, the word or the notion of intuition is actually used in philosophy, actually in contemporary philosophy, in political philosophy, which is where I work or where I normally move. But it could be, it's useful perhaps to distinguish the way that Bergson and Shaler understand intuition from other ways in which it is the term is understood in philosophy and also in everyday language, right? In everyday language, we say, I have the intuition, I don't know, that someone to me, say, in order to say that I have the hunch or the feeling that that is the case, but even if I don't have any evidence
I
about it.
Explain why, I just sense this, yes.
Right. Or more philosophically speaking, and this is the way in which Rawls, John Rawls, a political philosopher, uses the word intuition in order to identify convictions or judgments about the morality of particular actions. So for instance, the conviction that all human beings are morally equal, that's a sort of moral intuition, something that we a conviction, or perhaps, as I said, a judgment about the morality of a particular action. Or perhaps, as people called ethical intuitionists use the word, as self-evident moral propositions. Again, it's wrong to kill somebody else, right? Something like that. Kant also uses the word to refer to a representation, something that we recognize and then tie to a concept. So for instance, this microphone that I have in front of me, I cognize the microphone, I have the intuition of the microphone, I connect it to the concept microphone. So all those alternatives are not the way in which Bergson and Shaler use the word intuition. So for them, intuition is, first of all, a human ability, or perhaps better put, a human power. It is distinct both from reason and sensibility, because it's an ability or power that addresses something that is neither rational nor sensuous, right? So the way Bergson puts it sometimes is that intuition aims at something ineffable and immaterial, something that slips away the philosopher's attempt to see it and grasp it. And what is that slips away? What is the object of intuition is understood as an ability or a power. So in the book, what I want to say is that intuition translates in both of them. There are differences, but first into a certain conception of freedom, a certain conception of individuality, and a certain conception of authority that we should be interested in exploring. So that's what intuition means for them.
Okay. Let's start with individuality. They, as I understand it, offer a defense of sorts of individuality, or they like individuality. And I think a lot of listeners are probably thinking, oh no, individuality, that's going to, talking about rugged individualism, and that's hardly what we need. Mm-hmm. How are they defending individuality, and how, what does that have to do with intuition?
Yeah, so perhaps I can say something about Bergson first here. Individuality has to do with, in his case, with what he takes as the primary datum of experience, which perhaps some of your listeners are familiar, perhaps others are not, is movement and change, right? So for Bergson, that's the primary experience of that we have, right? And that means that experience of our inner reality is like that as well. So movement and change means that our inner self is primarily multiple. And that makes it difficult to grasp and difficult to define or to anchor to some definition. Mm-hmm. So
could I Right. And when I originally thought about inner multiplicity, I thought, oh, that will mean, you know, that we have different drives that are conflicting, but it's really not that at all. It's a lot more complex than that. I wondered, before you get to Sheila, I mean, you finish on Bergson, mm-hmm. but I was very interested in this idea of the cinematographic illusion. But continue on with
what I was going to say, it's directly related to that. So, okay. It's, as you said, it's not about drives. It's not about, you know, and in that sense, it's not a Freudian mm-hmm. conception of the self or a Humean conception of the self about, you know, the bundle of sensations or whatever. So it has to do with time. It has to do with, the centrality of the notion of duration and time in Bergson for an adequate comprehension of individuality. Precisely due to the importance of time in Bergson's thought, in order to understand his theory of individuality, it's important to say something about his theory of memory and the role that the brain plays in it. So according to Bergson's theory of memory, the past never disappears. It is constantly there and it's never dead, but on the contrary, prone to constant transformation. So what he calls a cinematographic illusion is the idea that the past disappears, right? Like the images of a film disappear from the screen. And for Bergson, that is wrong. The past doesn't go away, he says. Instead, he proposes that the past duplicates the present incessantly. And so his view is that the past is preserved in its entirety. And the job of the brain is not to remember, but to forget, right? To stop perceiving what is past,
what is not present. I mean by blowing my mind.
Yeah, I know.
Okay, keep going, yes.
Okay, so what does that mean? I mean, what does it mean to say that the past does not disappear? So it's surely not the case that he has any hopes of humanity eventually being able to travel in time or something like that, right? So Bergson's idea is that we stand in at the bottom of a corner of this sort of inverted cone, right? That he calls it the cone metaphor. And this cone represents the constant accumulation of the past. At each one of the levels of this cone, we find the totality of the past. So it's not that, you know, the base of the cone is like the remote past or whatever. So mm-hmm. at each level, we find the totality of the past, but at different degrees of contraction or expansion. So he says that more specifically, the cone displays different levels of consciousness at which we experience different ways of relating to our past, more pragmatic, more direct, or more convoluted or, you know, complex. For Bergson, the only possible access that we have to individuality is by digging tunnels into this cone, so to speak, mm-hmm. exploring the multiple ways in which we can, you know, traverse it's different levels. So, and that is the other idea that I present in the book. Bergson teaches that the past is of those who mix their labor with it, right? So the more you appropriate your past by digging these tunnels, the more you put yourself in a position to exercise individuality. And that's what I've called the Bergson's alternative labor theory of value.
Right.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. There was this quotation, he says, every moment of our life presents, I'm getting this from your book, every moment of our life presents two aspects, actual mm-hmm. and virtual. Perception on the one side and memory on another. Every moment of life is split up as and when it is posited, or rather it, I guess life, consists in this very splitting.
Yeah.
And another point was, if you could talk more about this. I think this idea of inner diversity, and as opposed to sort of an outer homogeneity. One of the quotations is, our tendency to form a clear picture of this externality of things. And the homogeneity of their medium is the same as the impulse which leads us to live in common and to speak.
Yeah. So there's two ideas in what you said. First, this whole idea of the past duplicating the present. That is admittedly very obscure, and Bergson have, you know, people have made fun of Bergson of this theory that the past does not disappear, that it's like, you know, a dimension that we are not able to perceive, but it's there. My sense is, I don't know to what extent, my sense is that he did believe that, like, literally. Mm-hmm. But in any case, independently from whether you believe that's physically correct or not, I guess the effect is of thinking, this alternative way of thinking about time, is that it sort of undermines the idea that of a more plain or flat relation to the past just through mere images, right? So, and here, I don't know if you've seen this series, Black Mirror. Well, it's a, you know, Netflix series. And so there's one episode in which they propose that there's a digital mechanism which is sort of installed in the brain called the grain, and that allows people to watch on demand selected scenes of their passes in a film, and their whole life is recorded with their eyes serving as cameras that shoot everything they see, and whenever they want they can, you know, scroll through the grain, that's how they call it, watching redos either through their own eyes or projecting them in whatever screen is available so that other people can see what they've recorded through their eyes, right? So from a Bergsonian perspective, the past is not really preserved in this example of Black Mirror. Rather, it's, so to speak, a theft to us for the cinematographic illusion of movement. While we passively sit and watch what the camera, in this case, our eyes, has captured for us, right? But the idea, his idea, is that actually a proper relation to the past is toilsome and is constant. And it's by laboring with our past constantly and you know, with all the demands that has every day, not through images that are, you know, easily seen, but through an toilsome exercise that involves, you know, effort and expectation, activity and passivity, engagement and patience, that allows us to achieve freedom. So his point is that by relating to our past, we can create our future. And that's what individuality and freedom are ultimately about. Mm-hmm. So I guess this point, you know, aside from this very strange and idiosyncratic theory of the past, is that by dealing with our past in the proper way, not in the easy way, mm-hmm. we can actually build our individuality and create our future. And in that sense, his conception of individuality is individuality as self-creation mm-hmm. through a proper relation to our past. So that's what's interesting, I think.
Right. No, I see what you're saying. And I guess before you go to Shaler, I think one of the things you point out is that it is somewhat deflationary in the sense that it's not just that we have this will that we can exercise.
So that's a deflationary conception of the self. That's what you mean?
Yes.
Yeah, and as if the will, you know, individual will, was something simple. And I guess Bergson's point is that, and in that's why it's not, you know, this individualism, like easy
yes.
individualism that, you know, perhaps people see in liberal theory or liberalism or in, you know, capitalism and liberalism together. Right. But it's a more complicated and not easily available conception of individuality.
Right. It's a defense of individuality, but not the typical defense, and not one that leads to or it's a celebration or a emphasis on the prominence of individuality without it leading to individualism.
Right. I think that's right.
And for Shaler, this was fascinating and mind-blowing. I guess in my notes, I tried to summarize it saying emotions perceive values. And I don't know if that was an oversimplification, mm-hmm. but that was fascinating to me.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's correct. So for Shaler, instead of, you know, an emphasis on time, I mean, Shaler knew Bergson and was interested in him. But so for him, the possibility of experiencing inner diversity lies primarily in what he calls perception of value in German Wertnehmung. So his view is that we perceive values just as we perceive, you know, this microphone, this glass of water, through our emotions, through our feelings. And in that sense, emotions or feelings are sort of, you know, like, perceptors of something that wouldn't be available for us if we didn't have this dimension of experience, which is the, you know, our emotional dimension. So for him, there is a hierarchy of values from he's very schematic. He's in that sense, very old fashioned author. Mm-hmm. And he proposes a hierarchy of values from the more material to the more, to the spiritual dimension and the parallel stratification of our emotional life, according to which different types of feelings correspond to different spheres of value. So at each level, feelings are, as I said, receptor organs with which we perceive the corresponding values. And the importance of this hierarchy lies in Shaler that for Shaler in that individuality becomes possible only through the proper identification of the different ranks of value. Mm. That's his idea.
So individuality was one, agency, freedom, just proceeding through your excellent book, if we'd go to agency, chapter two, I thought, let's talk about Kant and, maybe you could tell the listeners about the gallows man example and awareness of the ought and your alternative awareness.
Yeah, so I mean, I don't know to what extent the listeners are going to be familiar with Kant. So perhaps I can clarify first Kant's views. We can show how then what I propose in the book based on Bergson offers a different route to morality based on the phenomenon of temptation. Right. So Kant famously held that morality reveals us freedom as a fact. So we know the moral law first, and then we know ourselves to be free. That is why morality, according to Kant, is the ratio cognoscendi of freedom, right? Freedom, in turn, in his view, makes morality possible because it is our capacity to reject our empirically determined interest, that is inclination, drives, in favor of a moral course of action, right? So he says that freedom is the ratio essendi of morality. And Kant illustrates his theory with an example of a man who is demanded by his prince on pain of immediate execution to give false testimony against an honorable person whom the prince could like to get rid of, mm-hmm. right? So this man, famously known as the gallows man, is like everybody else, empirically determined by multiple desires and instinct. Yet Kant says, when our man is presented with the prince's mortal threat, he is capable of overcoming what determines him empirically, because as soon as he becomes aware of his duty to save the man who's about to be killed by the prince, he discovers freedom. Mm-hmm. Right. And that is Kant's famous awareness of the ought, the famous fact of reason, which obliges us and at the same time makes us discover our freedom. And in that sense, freedom is forced upon us. He says we ought and therefore we can. And thus, as the example shows, freely we do. So what I do in the book is I propose a different reading of Kant's mini story, mm-hmm. which I approach a bit narratively. Mm-hmm. It's a vignette, really, in Kent, not a full story, but I approach it like narratively as a sort of criminal case, with Kent as the main witness telling us what happened, what the prince commanded, the mental state that the gallows man was in, as if we had to determine, like a detective or a member of the jury, what really happened there with the gallows man. So according to my interpretation, in which I use Bergson's phenomenological approach to human action based on intuition, and again, trying to read Kant's report as closely as possible, the gallows man discovers freedom not through the categorical character of the moral law, as Kant, Kant's own interpretation proposes, but through the extent to which he experiences his own capacity for action. So if you agree, I guess we can perhaps review very, very quickly for the audience the few lines that I focus on in Kant. So just a very quick, brief quotation. So Kant says that once a prince has threatened the gallows man, we can ask him, so the gallows man, whether if his prince demanded, on pain of the same immediate execution, that he give false testimony against an honorable man whom the prince would like to destroy under a plausible pretext, he would consider possible to overcome his love of life, however great it may be. He would perhaps not venture to assert whether he would do it or not, but he must admit without hesitation that it would be possible for him. He judges, therefore, that he can do something because he's aware that he ought to do it, and cognizes freedom within him, which, without the moral law, would have remained unknown to him. So that's end of quote. So notice then that there seems to be a chronological priority of the gallows man's unhesitating awareness of his agency. He must first admit without hesitation that it would be possible for him to sacrifice himself, and therefore he judges that he can do it. So I could, therefore I can.
Right.
And only later he judges that he can do it because he ought to do it. Right. The famous "I ought, therefore I can." So I play with the idea that there is an awareness of the could prior to the famous awareness of the ought, and that's the whole idea that it's our awareness that we can do something that, or in that sense, the feeling that we're tempted to do something that allows us to discover freedom. Of course, in this case, the gallows man is tempted by, not by, you know, a drive or an inclination in the normal sense of the word. The relevant experience of temptation here is to save an innocent person. So the gallows man is a martyr because he's tempted by justice. And that is the first categorical experience, so to speak, that we can get in the example. So it's a reinterpretation of Kant's own example that I propose following Bergson's theory of morality to say that temptation is the ratio cognoscendi of freedom, because it enjoys, phenomenologically speaking, a prior status.
Right. You refer to a phenomenology of temptation, a phenomenology of hesitation. There's that moment when the agent realizes that, okay, the prince is commanding me to do this, and I could not. Is that momentary pause there?
Yeah, is the realization that we could actually disobey the prince and save the man, right? Not out of sense of duty, but, you know, out of sense of possibility. It's I can save that man, and therefore I do it. And I mean, normally when we think about temptation, for instance, when we think about addiction, we think of that as a, you know, very oppressive and something that traps you in a way. And my point in this chapter is to show that, of course, I mean, that's of course true. Temptation and in the sense of, addiction and that kind of things, of course, can trap a person and make that person unfree in very horrible ways. But what I want to propose is that temptation is, you know, multiple. On the one hand, yes, it can trap us when, for instance, you know, you're addicted to something, But on the other hand, it can make you feel your agency. Mm. The fact that you're not determined by your drives, that there's some sort of hesitation, that there's some sort of margin. Mm-hmm. And in that moment of hesitation, that moment of temptation, in that sense, you can feel your agency. Even if, of course, if temptation is, if you fall and you miss that moment of hesitation and you become addicted in a more, you know, oppressive way, then of course that's lost. But that's the idea.
That's very helpful. Thank you. I want to move to chapter three. I don't want to. There's so much in chapter three. The morality of uncertainty. Could you tell us about maybe Bergson and the virtual instinct, fabulation, another mind blowing?
Yeah. So, let me perhaps tell you first. So the main ideas of a chapter, the main idea, and then I can go
on
ahead to, yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And then I can talk a little bit about virtual instinct. Perfect. So, the idea is that I'm still talking about Bergson, uncertainty provides a kind of opportunity for agency, right? Mm-hmm. So it's a condition of possibility for agency. And this means two things. First, the idea that reality, what surrounds us, sort of mirrors the human agent. And so uncertainty as a characteristic of reality provides an opportunity to model our agency in a more dynamic, less determined way. So reality as something uncertain gives some flexibility to our agency. Mm-hmm. Another way of putting this is uncertainty would offend a completely defined and established personality, for which only the categorical would be apt. Mm-hmm. On the contrary, contingency is not necessarily an embarrassing match for what remains supple and unfinished anyway, right? Mm-hmm. So that's the first idea. Second idea is that different ways of understanding uncertainty allow us to model our agency differently, right? So a moderate approach to uncertainty allows us to forge an identity capable of relying both on habit and improvisation, and in that sense, remain flexible.
Right.
So those are the main ideas of the chapter. And then the part of on virtual instinct. So what Bergson says is that an animal, a non-human animal, has only instinct. And therefore, there is in a way, there's no uncertainty for this animal. Mm-hmm. But when we have intelligent animals, intelligent in the sense of, having language, and therefore not relying on instinct only, because we are intelligent, uncertainty appears, right? Uncertainty as the gap between our expectations and our plans and reality. And Bergson's idea is that for these kind of animals, intelligent animals, in the sense of, having language, so human animals, mm-hmm. We don't have instinct in that sense, in the sense of animals, but we have virtual instinct. And such an instinct, he says, will allow us to cope or deal with the discouragement in action follows from the limits of rational insight into the future.
Yes.
Right. So virtual instinct is sort of like the what we have instead of the proper animal instinct that allows us to cope with that disappointment. And he says, well, for he's here, Bergson deals with all this literature of anthropology, dealing with primitives, quote unquote, right, people, which was very strong at the time. And he says, well, this primitive people, again, quote unquote, are not that different from, modern civilized people,
right?
Because we all have this virtual instinct, although in different ways. For primitive people, again, quote unquote, there's this myth making faculty, this idea of think about taboos, this fabulation, this sort of myths and fabulations that allow them to make sense of the world. And from from the point of view of civilized man, as he mm-hmm. using the language of the 20th century, mm-hmm. That seems ridiculous or preposterous. But actually, we are very much like them. That's what Bergson says, and our conception of chance chance. He offers a very interesting analysis of our conception of chance and how it's actually very similar to, you know, it performs a very similar function as the taboos, for instance, in primitive people. And the idea is that chance, even if we like to think that it's, you know, very scientific and statistics and all that kind of thing, is actually a sort of half personal half personal idea that allows us to relate to uncertainty in a more personal way. So when we say, oh, you were very lucky, luck was with you. We sort of personify the idea of chance or fortune. Well, actually, fortuna is, you know, the more clearly personal conception of chance in that sense. And he said, if you see how modern civilized people use the word chance, you see that it's like a partner, it's like a peer, like something that comes with you and that allows you to relate to uncertainty in a more personal human way. Mm-hmm. And so it's this
mystic cause for the quote unquote civilized. Right?
I
will leave this to the listeners to read the book, but there was this really nice turn of phrase. First of all, you introduced the French philosopher and poet Jean-Marie Guillou. Mm-hmm. And I'll just leave chapter 3 with this quote of yours. While chance gives rise to expectations and predictions, risk, the wild twin brother of chance, always elicits our love or our aversion. That was a very nice turn of phrase. Guillou will be talking about risk instead of chance.
Yeah, Guillou, I mean, this is a very obscure personality and figure, but I use him to contrast his idea of risk with Bergson's idea of chance. Mm-hmm. and to show how if our approach to uncertainty is not moderate, like if risk, contingency, and insecurity are given a preeminent focus in you know, personal and political thought, when they are turned into the main problems to be addressed, we are usually left with, you know, two options, either total insurance against risk at the cost of liberty. So think of Hobbes's Leviathan, mm-hmm. or, you know, the absurdity of experiencing risk for the mere joy of it. Right. What I propose is that Bergson's conception of chance offers us a more moderate way to approach uncertainty.
Right. Let's see. I'd really like to spend time on chapter 4, which is the Shaler's conception of sympathy versus Smith's, but I think we have so little time. Let's move on to chapter 5 on mm-hmm. authority. How can a person who has this inner diversity be bound by authority?
Yeah, so the last chapter is a reflection. Well, it's an effort to answer that question, right? Like, what kind of authority is best suited to address the individual, in Bergson and Shaler sense, the individual that is, you know, understand as multiple, not the, you know, liberal individual understood as, you know, having only a will or a will, My answer is that the best way of understand the kind of authority that is best suited to address this individual is not that of the law, but that of another person. Mm-hmm. And by this, I do not want to say that the law cannot properly address us, but that we would be losing something very important if we neglected personal authority.
Right.
So this yields a conception of personal authority that, you know, compared to Weberian rational authority, or perhaps more recently, you know, for political philosophers or legal philosophers, Ras's epistemic authority is allegedly better at speaking to us meaningfully, more persuasively, more compellingly as an authority. And that corresponds to their personalist outlook, and that, I mean, it's a conception of authority known as exemplarity. And of course, I mean, today, I don't think I need to say much about the dangers associated with personalist politics, right? Today, we hear a lot about charismatic authority and how democracies die, populism, the dangers associated with strong men, and all the lessons we should remember to avoid tyranny, right? So all that's real. But my interest in exemplarity and in the specifically in the figure of Imitatio Christi that they both explore and analyze and use as a pedagogical resource that can teach us how to emulate admirable, exemplary people who exert an extraordinary pull on others is that in the midst of all the fears associated with charismatic and personal authority, we might very well lose sight of the fact that democracy also depends in crucial ways on these type of figures, right? And actually, I mean, many people have indicated this within the traditional political thought. A lot of people have talked about the importance of moral pioneers in, you know, one of the drivers of change in the ethos of society, right? Or for instance, very recently, Naomi Klein, in her book On Fire, acknowledges the superpower of Greta Thunberg, right, in order to spark the green movement and worries climate change and all that kind of thing. And of course, the classic example is Rousseau's figure of the legislator, without which the foundation of a truly just political community would be impossible. And when I look for in Shaler and Bergson's respective conceptions of exemplarity is to show that liberalism would only at its own peril deny the anthropological, moral, and political importance of those figures who, in the famous words of Rousseau, can compel without violence and persuade without convincing, right? So that's the interest.
Right, and then that leads us to, there are lots of great, you talk about an ethics of imitation, Shaler's defense of an elusive aristocracy. Could you spend a moment of all these on Bergson's modern defense of ostracism, which I thought was very interesting?
Yeah, so...
And on the value of humility, I guess.
Yeah, so perhaps I can say something about this ethics of imitation or emulation that I identify both in Bergson and Shaler, and which I think, I mean, going back to your point about individualism, are, you know, especially apt corrective to that kind of problem. So think of perhaps our audience has heard this term of ethics of authenticity that Charles Taylor articulated in the 90s. And his idea that was that, you know, of course, modern individualism and, you know, the narcissism and competitiveness and egoism that goes with that is very troubling. And, you know, we have to think about that. But Taylor's idea was that there's an ethics, an important moral ideal behind that individualism that needs to be recovered in order to understand the force of individualism, right? And his point was there's like a good version of it that needs to be recovered so that we can actually be properly guided by it. And that was his ethics of authenticity, the idea that, you know, each one of us is trying to become what oneself truly is, right? And to find or build, perhaps, I don't know what the right word is, our own authentic, unique personal self. And interestingly, what I find in Bergson and Shaler is a sort of ethics of emulation that tries to find a way, of moral growth and a way to individuality tries to find individuality by way of imitating another.
Yeah.
And
which is that, what we do, indeed.
Yes. I mean, on the one hand, today with social media and all that, like a lot of followers, that what you want to have, but that's what you are as well. So you might better find the right way of following and the right way of imitating others. And their point is that by way of emulating, like rightly emulating other people, which of course doesn't mean copying their way exactly or literally, but you know, entails an exercise of, you know, an analogy, like what would whoever do in my situation, right? Of course, you're not Jesus, you're not Napoleon, you're not Greta Thunberg, but what would that person do in my case? Sure. And that exercise they propose combines, on the one hand, an acceptance, humility, and acceptance of personal authority and the existence of exemplary people. On the other hand, it's an exercise of, you know, applying your that example to your situation, and in that sense, getting to know yourself and your own particular situation, but in a humble, more humble way.
Yeah. And so, in a way you can really feel as opposed to a rational law.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, in a way that you can identify with in your personally.
Yes.
Instead of following, you know, rule of thumb or a general rule, right. Which again doesn't mean that there is no place for general rules or laws or whatever. That's not my point. The point is that there is some dimension of experience that would only be able to that can only be addressed by other people, or the example of other people. So yeah, I think that's interesting, especially in the context of where individualism still is a concern, just as in the 90s with Taylor.
Right.
And I think it's an interesting alternative. I mean, I really like Taylor and his idea that we need to actually bring forth the best version of that individualism. But perhaps this is an actually, you know, it's an interesting alternative way, the ethics of emulation that we could try in order to address that individualism.
Right. It's fascinating. The book is The Belief in Intuition, Individuality and Authority in Henri Bergson and Max Shaler. Thank you so much for speaking with me, Professor Alfaro. It's been a pleasure.
No, thank you for the invitation. It's been a pleasure for me.